From KLCC Radio, you're tuned in to a special presentation, Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. I'm Love Cross. You've heard of Black Friday and Cyber Monday, but the Tuesday following Thanksgiving has become known as Giving Tuesday. It seems that this year, more than ever, the generosity of those who put their time, talents, and resources into helping their friends and neighbors is essential to keeping our communities intact. In this hour, we'll hear from those who are feeding the hungry, teaching life-changing skills, and inspiring young minds. Plus, we'll check in on location at the Upper Mackenzie Community Center and discuss ways the communities surrounding Blue River are helping one another out during this especially turbulent time.
People contacted their neighbors and friends immediately when they knew, and everybody got out because people helped each other.
All that and more coming up on Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. Hello and welcome to this special presentation from KLCC, Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. I'm Love Cross. To get a better idea about the overall state of giving, we start this hour learning about the Oregon Community Foundation. They work alongside donors throughout Oregon, stewarding their priorities into strategic giving to support diverse communities across the state, creating lasting, transformative change. I'd like to welcome Max Williams, President and CEO of the Oregon Community Foundation, and Sarah Brandt, OCF's Senior Philanthropic Advisor and Regional Director for the Southern Willamette Valley Region. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you. Good to be here.
We're talking to you on this Giving Tuesday, which is a movement that's mainly an idea that encourages people to transform their communities and the world by doing good. This comes in the form of volunteerism and monetary donations. Max, can you tell us how the Oregon Community Foundation has a similar mission for doing good in local communities?
Sure. Happy to. We really have a privilege of being able to work with thousands of Oregonians who create charitable funds at the Community Foundation. And so these are individuals, businesses, and families who establish funds at OCF for the purpose of supporting nonprofits. Some of those are established testamentary. In other words, they leave a gift in their estate plan to support those nonprofits after they pass away. Others establish funds while they're living, sometimes referred to as donor advised funds, and they use those funds to recommend grants to nonprofits in the communities where they're doing that support. We also have nonprofits who have their endowment funds that we steward at the Oregon Community Foundation. So they have an endowment that they're working to build to support the organization, and we hold and manage that endowment and make distributions to them on an annual basis. And then we also manage numerous scholarships around the state, one of the largest scholarship programs in the country for a community foundation. So thousands of Oregon students receive annual scholarships as a result of donors across the state who generously created these scholarship funds. So in total, all of those resources, along with resources that have been gifted to the foundation to use for purposes directed by our board, make grants and distributions annually in a normal year of about $100 to $130 million a year. This year, because of all the extending circumstances of COVID, the Black Lives Matter movement, and the fire response, we've done grant making to this point in November of in excess of $170 million. So it's been a tremendous outpouring of generosity and support from both our donors and from Oregonians generally, supporting literally thousands of nonprofits around the state that are providing direct services to Oregonians in need.
This truly has been a unique year across the country and here in Oregon. From organizations grappling with the pandemic to the devastation from this summer's historic wildfires, I understand OCF has established some specific grants this year, like the Community Rebuilding Fund. Max, can you tell us more about how OCF has had to be reactive to this year's events?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. This is a year like no one in Oregon or the country, I think, has experienced before. And particularly in Oregon, we feel like it's sort of been a triple whammy with the fires there on the end that that we've experienced, and not just in one community, but in many communities around the state. So early in our COVID response, we established several pooled funds. One of them was called the Oregon Community Recovery Fund. But we also had a pooled arts fund and a small business stabilization fund. And we worked again with individuals and donors, our partners in philanthropy, other foundations around the state, like the Ford Family Foundation, the Meyer Memorial Trust, the Collins Foundation, and others, to establish these pooled funds so we could have a more effective means of responding to a nonprofit need. We opened a grant portal that allowed nonprofit organizations to request immediately. We had almost $90 million in grant requests, obviously larger than we were able to respond to. But simultaneously, our donors with their donor funds responded. We had charitable contributions from corporations, as I said, other foundations, individual Oregonians who just wanted to find a place where they could give money to give back to community. And then we ran, again, remotely, because we moved remote like everybody else, the largest grant-making effort in the history of the foundation. So just in COVID response alone, we did more than $30 million in grant response on COVID-related grants to nonprofits, many of whom we were helping bridge between the emergent circumstances they were in and the longer-term support they were either going to get from state or federal government support through the PPP or other programs. With the fires, we activated our donors not to initially create an emergency fund at OCF. We really directed our donors to all the local community emergency funds, not wanting to be sort of an extra intermediary step there. And within the first week or two, more than $1.5 million of OCF donor directed money went into those emergency funds. The governor then chose to call on OCF, and we established a pooled fund in cooperation again with the Meyer Memorial Trust and the Ford Family Foundation, focused on not emergency response to the fire need, but a fund that will be there over the next 3 to 5 years dealing with long-term recovery. And we're still raising funds for that. We hope to get that fund in excess of $10 million. We're sitting somewhere between $6 and $8 million right now, and we're continuing to work with, again, corporations, other philanthropic organizations, and individual donors to raise that money to be, again, kind of this pool of philanthropic resources that can help these various communities in ways perhaps that FEMA or state or federal dollars can't be used to try to support them in their long-term efforts of recovery.
So given the challenges that Max just described that organizations have faced over these past 8 months, Sarah, I'm curious to know how the needs of organizations might have changed throughout our area as well.
You know, it does vary from sector to sector, but I think that a lot of the need that we saw had to do with sustaining them, with helping them bridge a very difficult time. And for some organizations, gifts continued to flow in because it was very evident that they were on the front lines of responding to whichever crisis it was. For some other organizations, they needed to buy some time to regroup. Arts organizations are a great example of that. So we had arts organizations that, you know, had to cancel seasons immediately and try to figure out how to present virtually and examples like that. We had many youth programs that also, you know, closed for a while, but needed to regroup and reopen and figure out a different way to provide their services, especially to those who were providing childcare for families of first responders and medical personnel. So I would say broadly, it just fell into that camp of how do we forge forward at a pace we've never done before because we're on front lines, or how do we hang in there? We saw a lot of very creative responses, and we also saw applications from organizations we've never granted to before who sought OCF out.
So along that same vein, how do you think nonprofits are generally doing overall in this trying year? You know, what is the general health of nonprofits in our area?
Well, I think we're concerned, just like I think everyone is, about how long this lasts and what the impact will be. Certainly a number of, you know, we provided resource. We weren't alone, right? Lots of other people in Oregon stepped up philanthropically, individually through other funds and corporate contributions, and donors to these nonprofits who sustain and supported them all along, I think, have been stepping up to help. Obviously, the federal money through the PPP and some of the state dollars added some extension to that effort for the organizations that were able to qualify and receive those funds. I think as those dollars are starting to finish up, and you know they've spent them all, they're spent out. The CARES Act money needs to be spent out by the end of the year. I think there's some real concern about the long-time survivability of a number of nonprofit organizations in Oregon. And as the economic circumstances are sort of having this two-tiered impact where some people are feeling it really severely and other people are not, I think we're figuring out that there's a lot more to do around supporting people, particularly that are towards the bottom third of the socioeconomic structure in this state. This pandemic and the circumstances here have not been equally distributed across the population. It's disproportionately impacted communities of color, BIPOC communities, and rural poor communities in Oregon in a really disproportionate way. So much of our grant making and the support that we've been giving to nonprofits has been targeted through that lens, a lens of trying to get resources into the hands of the nonprofit organizations that are addressing those people most disproportionately impacted on the front lines. And those organizations are frankly too important to go away. They need to be sustained and supported because they are really a frontline defense in this widening poverty gap that people are experiencing that I think is only becoming wider as a result of the impact of the pandemic. I was listening to a podcast on my walk this morning that talked about how there's just clear data to show that the people who are most impacted are people in the lower paying jobs, the service industry jobs that aren't coming back. And with additional closures now underway across Oregon to try to address the health needs of the pandemic, I think we're just elongating the negative impacts on that population. And so it's essential that we be generous, that those who are working and are well situated are willing to be generous. And that's one of the great things about a Giving Tuesday is it brings forward in everybody's presence this need to sort of open and be generous to those in our communities who are less fortunate. And we really hope that that message gets out.
So when we come out on the other side of all the things 2020 has thrown at us, what sector of nonprofits do you think is going to need the most help?
If we're talking about individual impacts, kind of at that emergent basic needs area, again, I think this is going to be a split recovery. Lots of people are already recovered from the initial March downturn, and certain industries are doing just as well as they were beforehand. Certain areas of sales are up, not down. I mean, so there's, the stock market, for no reason I can possibly fathom, continues to do things that just doesn't make sense to me. But what that really means is there is a huge separation between who's benefiting or at least who's not experiencing this recession and who is. And I think there are long-term consequences to the recovery, and we have to think very deeply if we weren't already, and we at OCF were already in this space, but collectively as a community and as a new administration coming into Washington, we have got to think about the impact of the poverty gap that is existing in this country. And I'm worried about how long that's going to take. And I'm worried that some of those jobs aren't going to come back. More than 50% of Americans work in small businesses. Small businesses are the ones that are being impacted by this. The large corporate infrastructures aren't as much. And I'm worried about what that does to a whole bunch of people, particularly in Oregon, where we don't have very many large businesses. Most of the jobs are small business related. And that long-term impact for people who are employed in small businesses is going to create a serious economic drag for us. And so I'm worried about the arts infrastructure because I don't know what that looks like. But what keeps me up is this two-tiered recovery that we're going to experience and what that means to, middle and low-income Oregonians who may be out of work for a lot longer and not having sufficient community-based resources to be able to help them get through the recovery.
Max and Sarah, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, love.
That's Max Williams and Sarah Brandt with the Oregon Community Foundation. To learn more about what they do and how you can get involved, you can head to our website, klcc.org, or visit oregoncf.org. You're listening to Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. And just a quick editorial note, Oregon Community Foundation is a KLCC program underwriter. Every weekend, without fail, even in 2020, Burrito Brigade volunteers prep, cook, and distribute hundreds of vegan burritos across Eugene and Springfield. While some adjustments were made, COVID-19 hasn't slowed or prevented operations. KLCC's Mallory Begay stopped by a volunteer session to learn more.
14 volunteers are spread out inside a large kitchen with two people at each table. This is the brigade. They've met every Saturday and Sunday since 2014 to churn out about 700 vegan burritos each weekend to feed anyone in need of a hot meal.
Right now we are processing 25 pounds of tomatoes, 12 pounds of carrots, 15 pounds of potatoes. We got local tomatillos donated.
That's Executive Director Jennifer Denson. She and everyone in the kitchen is wearing a mask in accordance with COVID-19 safety guidelines.
COVID definitely changed the way we did everything. And the nice thing is that every other week we are here at Food Pulling County.
In addition to masking up, volunteers wear gloves and try to distance themselves from others as much as possible. Most of the people volunteering are part of a core group to prevent contact with new people.
It's important to us that we haven't skipped a weekend. So when COVID hit, you know, we had to make a lot of choices as an organization, and it was interesting to even think about trying to put it on hold, but hunger really doesn't take a hold.
The concept and execution of what the Burrito Brigade does is straightforward. Feed the hungry using simple vegan-friendly ingredients and make it tasty. Volunteer and board member Liz Herkus says that's why she got involved.
Everything is just kind of growing out of this grassroots effort. And so I feel like that's really endearing, and it's also really neat to be part of it at the beginning. We Burrito Brigade has been around for 5 years, and we're trying to grow and grow and grow.
Herkus scoops a mixture of beans and roasted veggies onto a tortilla and rolls them up in aluminum foil. It's the last stop before the burritos are placed in an insulated bag and are sent out to people in need.
The Burrito Brigade is doing the burritos, but we also do food pantries, and now we've started a food bank since the pandemic hit. So to be able to be a part of that and like help it grow more tangibly, I think it's a great opportunity.
Other than adopting safety measures and altering distribution methods, Jennifer Denson says they haven't faced any significant challenges this year. She attributes their resilience to community support.
We are super thankful for our community. I mean, we've been going at this because of the community. The community has supported us from the beginning. And anytime we did a call out for beans or rice or any supply that we needed, the community stepped up.
Well, the organization has started new projects this year. Denson says they've also seen an uptick in people in need of a hot meal. The issue of food insecurity is vast, she adds, and it affects a variety of people. But the brigade is there to help when they can. Mallory Begay, KLCC News.
You can find out more about Burrito Brigade and their need for volunteers and donations at their website, burritobrigade.org. You can hear their story again, as well as this entire program, at klcc.org. We also have links and contact information for the organizations we're featuring on this program. This music you're hearing right now and that you'll hear throughout the hour is provided to us by the Corvallis Youth Symphony Association. These are recordings made in 2019, back when public performances were possible. We'll be hearing from Executive Director Anissa Boulder later in the program about how they're keeping their music education program and performances going during the pandemic. Just ahead, we'll head up the McKenzie for a conversation about how the Upper McKenzie Community Center is providing much-needed support to the communities surrounding Blue River in the wake of the Holiday Farm fire. You're listening to Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. I'm Love Cross. You're listening to Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. I'm Love Cross. Beginning on September 7th, the Holiday Farm fire burned through the McKenzie River corridor, destroying 430 homes, taking one life, and displacing hundreds of families and several small, close-knit communities. As soon as residents could return to the area, local organizers sprang into action to help provide basic resources to everyone affected by the fire. The Upper McKenzie Community Center became one of three relief centers along Highway 126, and they'll stay that way for the foreseeable future as residents get back on their feet. We took a trip to the Upper McKenzie Community Center to learn more about the services they're providing and what community support means to them.
I'm Margaret Bielhars. I've been with the community center for 5 years now and lived in the community for about 50 years. This building was built with volunteers and donations in about 1960. The McKenzie River Drive, which is right near us, was the highway at that time, and we're right by the river also. At that time, there was about three times as many people living here because of the construction of the hydropower and flood control dams, the Cougar, Blue River, and Carmen Smith. So there was no TV and, of course, no internet, so there were still long winters and lots of families. So people banded together to build themselves a big hall and with a kitchen and other accessories to place to gather and have potluck dinners and dances and parties and kids play and weddings and memorials. And so it's been supported for the last 60 years in that way by donations and volunteers.
And so in this year of 2020, we've obviously had some pivoting by many organizations with COVID-19 and obviously the wildfires that swept through this area. But I'm curious to know about those events that you held before this time of COVID and the wildfires and what those have meant to the community over the years to have this gathering place.
In this rural area, people's homes are tucked back in the woods, so when there is an opportunity to gather at one place, people meet their neighbors and other people that they have not met before. We call this sometimes the 50-mile Main Street here because we are spread out over 50 miles between Eugene and McKenzie Bridge. So it's a great place to build relationships that then people rely on for their other activities, in fun and in business and school, and we all get to know each other, and it builds the ties that we needed to respond to this emergency. And the community center has put its emphasis on preparedness in the last 3 years, recognizing that there's lots of things that can be done ahead of time so people can respond to emergencies better, and building those relationships between people in the area has been really important that way.
Hi there, I'm John Carlisle. I'm a 3.5-year resident of beautiful McKenzie Bridge, and I'm currently managing the Rainbow Relief Center located here at the Upper McKenzie Community Center in Rainbow, Oregon. To give credit where it's due, I did evacuate to the east, so I was safe and sound for 8 days at Black Butte Ranch, and I returned once the level 3 went down to a level 2, and I decided it was safe. My home was spared. I'm at McKenzie Bridge. So when I returned the next day, I was wondering how I could volunteer where I was needed, and I found out that there was a relief effort going on here at the community center. And showed up with the intention of volunteering. And the folks that had shown up and set up this operation had been here for a few days and were starting to think about their exit strategy because they were from other places and were wanting to hand it off to the locals and give us a footprint and move forward and help our own situation out. And so I just kind of assumed a leadership role because I was local and I was available. And so I was handed an organization that had already been started by some kind folks that had managed to get here immediately when it was safe for them to drive around the fire line to get here and shown up with food and water and supplies and started the relief effort. And I kind of showed up a few days after they had gotten started and asked what I could do, and I'm still here.
Great. So why don't you go ahead and tell us what the relief efforts have been out of this building? What are you providing to the community? How are people accessing it? What has the response been from people that are looking for the resources you're providing?
Well, immediately it was an acute relief effort. You have to keep in mind that the power had been out for several days, so every single person had lost everything in their refrigerator and freezer. That all had to be thrown out. And you couldn't get to Eugene. So everybody was food insecure, no matter what your income level is or where you live. If you still had a home or had lost everything, no one had any food. We didn't have electricity or internet, so there was no ability to pump gasoline. So it was a real problem immediately, just the basics, the food, shelter, kind of water, fuel situation. And once the chaos kind of died down, and certainly once the roads opened up to Eugene, that kind of chaos went away. And now we're providing food security for folks that don't have access to get to Eugene. We don't have a bus service right now, so a lot of folks can no longer just go grocery shopping. And then the food insecurity was exacerbated by COVID for all summer, and then it was compounded exponentially by the fire. And so we're preparing and are hoping to provide food and clothing and that sort of thing through the winter for folks, because we are anticipating a long, cold, hard winter. And we know that the need is going to be present, and we're going to stay present to provide for that need.
Okay, and I understand that obviously one of the problems that has been a challenge up here has been that connectivity that you mentioned, and that there have been organizations that have come in to help with internet and other connectivity assistance throughout the whole McKenzie River Valley. How is that working out with the school efforts that are going on? Because I know that I've heard that, you know, people pull up in the parking lot to get Wi-Fi so that they can attend school. Yeah.
Yes. In fact, where we're sitting right now under this awning connected to the building is oftentimes where people will sit with their laptop and their phone because it's Wi-Fi accessible. That's an ongoing problem, and through the winter it's going to continue to be a problem. We have, fortunately, there are some hotspots set up at different locations, so folks can pull up in their car and get internet access. We also have some emergency cell service towers going on, bouncing signals from Hoodoo, and I don't even know where it's all coming from, but that's providing some cell service depending on who your carrier is and probably which way the wind's blowing at the time. But ultimately, that is going to be an ongoing problem for us, the communications and the lack of services. Keep in mind, we can't even dial 911 if you have an emergency right now on your landline, should you need to do that, because your landline's just not working right now. So we've got a lot of the older population that perhaps doesn't have a cell phone and isn't necessarily computer savvy, if they even had satellite internet access where they live. So those are the folks that I'm most concerned with moving forward through our winter season. We got to keep those folks in mind. Folks that maybe it's not easy for them to reach out to us, we need to make sure that we're reaching out to them.
Hi, I'm Kathy Jaworski, and I am a fairly new resident of McKenzie Bridge, and I have a background in nonprofits, so I kind of was invited to join the board of the community center, and I'm trying to help with all the things that are going on now. So, well, before the fire, we actually were working on a capital budget for this project, and it included things like after Snowmageddon, it became clear that we couldn't even rely on being able to move between Blue River and McKenzie Bridge in certain emergencies. And so we were looking at beefing it up for emergency use, looking at better internet. We finally got internet access for the first time, but soon before this, but making it sort of a hub for today's world, as well as that social gathering that Margaret talked about, that still remains really important in a community that doesn't have any incorporated cities, doesn't have any public gathering spots, and it's like the living room of the community. I mean, my first experience here was at the Ice Cream Social a week after we moved up. I just got recruited to come up and do that. The Christmas parties. We can't do those things now, but we will be able to, right? And so there's, for me, in terms of thinking forward, having worked in a lot of rural communities in my career, I think this is a time of challenge and sadness and grief and disconnection, but also of opportunity to kind of remake our connections and our places that help us sustain those connections in a better way even than they were before.
When the Holiday Farm Fire started and people had to leave the area, there were lots of questions about what people would be coming back to. What did you know or think you knew about the community center when all of that chaos was happening?
So I evacuated to Eugene and then to Bend, and there was no communication to anybody in here for about 48 hours. And even after that, it was unknown as to where the edge of the fire was. And at first the winds blew east, and then they turned around and blew west. And we knew the community center was very close to the edge of the fire. I mean, it's less than a quarter mile from the fire. So we really didn't know. We heard rumors both ways. It had burned, it had not burned. We didn't know, I'd say, for 2 weeks. But I want to say one thing about the role of community in this fire. The fact that only one person died, I think, speaks very highly to the fact that people contacted their neighbors and friends immediately when they knew, and everybody got out because people helped each other. We didn't rely entirely on the alert system or the fire department's ability to knock on doors. It was people checking on their neighbors and friends that got everybody out.
I'm curious to know what this experience has taught each of you briefly about humanity, but in the smaller context of this community where you've chosen to live.
I used to run a nonprofit that worked all over rural Oregon and Washington, so I've been in pretty much every community in the state of Oregon that's small. And we chose this community because in the process of my work, it is very extraordinary, both the challenge of having a 50-mile main street and the degree to which volunteers do everything despite those differences. So we chose it, and that was, I'm so glad that we did. But what I've seen in this community in terms of the initiative to do something, whatever it is, without having to have a big plan or a big organization or any money in your pocket, is amazing.
Yes, I've noticed that everybody offered what they could, and everybody had something different to offer, and together it made things work. We wouldn't want everybody to have the same skills or the same lifestyle or the same personality. It was because people were different and chose to work together. We had some great successes and still are having.
I just wanted to quote Fred Rogers. His mother always told him to look for the helpers. And there are a lot more if you look. There are a lot more helpers.
To learn more about the Upper Mackenzie Community Center, including ways you can help, visit uppermackenziecommunitycenter.org. You can also find contact information for all the organizations we're speaking with today at our website, klcc.org. Coming up, we'll check in with Downtown Languages, a Lane County organization that provides support to immigrant communities by way of education in English, U.S. civics, computer skills, and more. Plus, we all know that the pandemic has taken a severe toll on the arts community, but what about music education for youth? We'll hear from the Corvallis Youth Symphony Association, who's provided the music for our program, about how they're adapting to this time. That's all coming up on this special presentation, Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. I'm Love Cross. You're listening to Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday. I'm Love Cross. It's my pleasure to welcome from Downtown Languages, Claire Feehan, the Donor Relations Manager, and Brooke Edwards, the Interim Executive Director. Thank you both for joining us on this Giving Tuesday.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's just start off by having you explain what Downtown Languages does.
Yes, we serve Lane County, mostly Eugene Springfield area, and we provide tools and support to help immigrants improve their economic situation and civic participation. We help immigrant families more effectively support their children's education, and we directly support children from immigrant families or who are immigrants themselves in their education. And we do this all by offering specialized classes, which include English as a second language, citizenship exam preparation, computer skills, and family literacy, among other classes.
So it sounds like you offer quite a variety of programs. Can you just highlight one or two and tell us how that works?
Sure. I'd love to highlight our PLOS Family Literacy Program. This is a family literacy program for Latino families. And it's offered in coordination with two local school districts, the Bethel School District and the Springfield School District. This is an evening program in which families come together and then they spend part of their time separated into their respective groups. The adults go together to learn English and children go off to their respective classes in which, for instance, the preschoolers are gaining early literacy skills, fourth through eighth graders are getting help with their homework, and then they also come back together for part of the time to do family activities together, family learning activities, and also to be offered resources that might support the family.
It would seem that when you include the whole family in a program like that, it really helps bring them together. They're all working for a common cause. It's something that they can bond around, and it probably makes the impact of that learning even more significant.
That's right. There's a lot of information that families learning together is very, very effective. So that family literacy model is very effective. And it helps the parents support their children in their education. The parents are gaining a valuable skill in learning English, which can help improve their economic situation for the entire family. But they're also learning to support their children in a much better way, whether it's via their supporting them with their homework, being able to conference with their teachers, or attend school-based activities. So it does, it benefits the whole family. As they go through the program together. And there's some fun parts to it, too, that the family gets to do together, and it just encourages family learning.
I can only imagine the positive impacts that has on a family. So it sounds like you serve a variety of communities, not just the Spanish-speaking community.
In our adult classes, we can have students from 12 to 14 different countries. So, for example, from Belarus, as well as Guatemala, South Korea, Japan, Kyrgyzstan, Iran. So they're here for various reasons as well. So we do serve a very broad range of folks from different parts of the world. And then, as Brooke said, the PILAS Family Literacy Program is specifically for the Hispanic families.
Before we get into the impacts that community support has on the programs you offer, on your website, you highlight several different inspiring stories from people that you've helped over the past. Let's take a minute and listen to this from Walter.
My life is really hard when I was before downtown language because I didn't know how to speak English and writing. So people talking to me, I cannot say anything. So always I say something like, okay, like something, you know, but I don't know what they ask me or they told me. So if I go in the store, I didn't know what to buy, you know.
That's a really inspiring story. I mean, giving someone the gift of being able to go into a grocery store and know what to buy just through having them understand the language. I'm sure that every student and family that you have helped through Downtown Languages has their own story to tell. What do you hear from the students and families that you serve and how they've been impacted by participating in Downtown Languages?
I'm keenly aware that English is a difficult language. And so the thought of moving from a foreign country, a different country, and coming here and attempting to go into a grocery store where in their homeland they may have found one or two of the same item, of a, like they were looking for shampoo or looking for toilet paper, whatever, even looking for canned beans, there might be one or two options. So to walk into our grocery stores and see the array, the vast amount of products we have, and not understand what's written on the package is really a challenge. So just to go to the grocery store, to go to the post office, to put have gasoline put in your car, the simple things that we take for granted because we have language are really difficult for these folks.
What would you say is the biggest need for downtown languages right now?
Money, I would say. Yeah, you know, that's, yeah, donations, just to keep everybody involved and keep the classes going. And yeah, that's it, really.
That's what it comes down to. Yep.
We have a fundraiser going right now. I don't know if you know that, but we have one online happening, and soon, of course, we'll do our year-end appeal. But that's what we need. We need the community. We also just need the community to know about downtown languages, because really, it's a gem of an organization that's been, we've done a really good job of outreach to the immigrant community, but many of the other folks who don't need or use our services even know that we exist. So that outreach is really important for folks to tell everyone that this exists in the community.
Claire and Brooke, thank you so much for joining us on this Giving Tuesday and sharing more about downtown languages.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That's Claire Feehan, the Donor Relations Manager, and Brooke Edwards, the Interim Executive Director of Downtown Languages. To find out more about Downtown Languages, visit downtownlanguages.org. An editorial note, Downtown Languages is a KLCC program underwriter. One of the hardest hit sectors by the COVID-19 pandemic is the music industry, affecting venues, sound engineers, and of course, musicians. Access to the performing arts and access to education in the performing arts is such a vital part of the community, and providing that education to children has been at the core mission of area youth orchestras, including the Eugene Springfield Youth Orchestras. As Executive Director Holly Spencer puts it, fulfilling this mission in 2020 has been challenging, to say the least.
Like many of our colleagues, we've had to find new ways to fulfill our mission during this challenging year. Our board and staff have worked hard to create a program of online classes and rehearsals while maintaining the spirit of our youth orchestras. Most of all, the passion and dedication of our youth musicians has come shining through. Their positive energy and amazing flexibility inspires us all. They remind us of the importance of keeping music alive, especially during difficult times. We'll present their special winter concerts on December 15th and 16th over YouTube. We also launched online String Academy classes, and more than 130 students are now learning a stringed instrument for the first time. None of this would be possible without the support of our community and the belief in the power of music. Thank you.
The Corvallis Youth Symphony Association is adapting as well. You've been hearing music recorded live in concert by that orchestra last year throughout our program. We turn now to an audio postcard from Anissa Boulder, Executive Director of the CYSA, describing the challenges and solutions they've implemented this year. Boulder's words are accompanied by music performed by the orchestra, featuring selections from Dvorak's Cello Concerto.
The Corvallis Youth Symphony Association is a nonprofit organization based in Corvallis, serving in a normal year about 350 students in the Mid-Willamette Valley, third grade through 12th grade. We have an elementary strings program that's run at the public schools here for third through fifth grade students, and then middle school and high school youth symphony, full symphony programs. CYSA has been in Corvallis since 1982, so we're actually in our 39th season this year, and it is certainly a bizarre 39th season, but we are making it work and enjoying all the new things we're learning about running fully online programs for the first time ever. So we usually have about 7 concerts in a year between all of those orchestras. This year, we have, with fully online programming, we have a concert on Sunday, December 13th that will be watchable on our Facebook page and YouTube channel of our Corvallis Youth Symphony students performing in chamber ensembles and performing an excerpt of Dvorak's New World Symphony, all recorded online with each student in their own home, and these recordings all put together, but it's music that they've worked on together through our Zoom rehearsals over the course of the term that then they'll be presenting in this online format for the first time. There's no way to play with 2 people playing at the same time on a Zoom call. So to make it work, every single student is at home with their instrument and their music, and they are muted. And in a normal rehearsal, the conductor is conducting on the screen and playing a recording of a piece that everyone is playing along to on their own instrument at home. We also have students working in chamber ensembles through Zoom, which is not usually an element of our program that we incorporate in a typical year. So in their chamber ensembles, they have a piece that they're assigned or a piece that they choose. And then in just student-led groups, they work on a small ensemble piece. For string players, for instance, it's a string quartet. For brass students, it's a brass quintet, for example. And then they also will be recording those small ensemble pieces individually, putting the parts together, and then we'll be sharing out those recordings in December as well. I know that the students and we all miss live performances, playing together in a group. That's why we do this. But the opportunities to learn how to record to, for instance, recording to a click track, which is like a metronome beat that you have to play to in order to make these stacked recordings where multiple people are playing their own part in their own house and putting these parts all together. That is a skill that, I can say as a professional musician myself, is so important for using in the professional world. Anytime you make a recording, anytime you're playing live, for instance, live with a band, everything is basically done to a click track. We provide need-based scholarships to make sure that our program is accessible for every single student who wants to participate, regardless of finances. If they want to be there, we will make it happen. So that is a big place where donations are making a huge difference in our program, so that we can have that no matter what. If a family has a need, we can make sure that they can participate. We also provide, especially right now more than ever, we're bringing in professional coaches to be at our rehearsals. In a normal year, we would have coaches coming in probably a few times a concert set. Right now, because of needing more small group time when we're in these Zoom sessions, we have coaches coming in every single week. These are fantastic professional musicians in the community, so they're compensated for their time to provide their amazing services. So that's an extra cost that really helps our program really thrive right now. So we really try to make sure that students that want to be there can be there, have an instrument, and can participate no matter what else is going on. And we know right now families are struggling in so many ways. And so this year we've really gone out of our way to make sure that students have instruments and students can participate if they want to be there.
That was Anissa Boulder, Executive Director of the Corvallis Youth Symphony Association.
Their winter concert will be streamed on their Facebook page and YouTube channel on Sunday, December 13th. You can find out more about their programs and ways that you can help out at their website, cysassoc.org. And head to klcc.org to find a list of other local nonprofits doing good in our community. As we conclude this program, I'd like to note there are so many wonderful nonprofit organizations in our area that we couldn't possibly speak to all of them in the time we had for this broadcast. However, the spirit of Giving Tuesday is one that we hope to embrace the entire year, and know that we consider your comments, your PSA requests, and your suggestions very carefully. We're always trying to highlight the generous and inspiring work that's being done in our communities the best we can. You can always reach out to us, send us an email, klcc@klcc.org. Giving Back, KLCC's Guide to Giving Tuesday, was produced by Jason Brown and Renelle Curry. Special thanks goes out to Mallory Begay for her work. Thank you for listening. Thank you to all the organizations who decided to be a part of our broadcast. And thank you all for your generosity, whether it's toward KLCC or however you choose to invest in our communities. Your support, whether it's your time, your money, or simply your kindness, makes this place truly special. And it's one of the reasons why this is such a wonderful place to call home. I'm Love Cross. This is KLCC.